Court will proceed to the third case of the day, Alien Energy versus Bai et al. Mr. Piper.
May it please the court. Lion Energy is here to ask for reversal of the district court's decision with regard to five statutes, four of which are under the Wisconsin Utility Holding Company Act and a separate statute that applies to the public utility. Wisconsin's in-state incorporation statute requires any person who owns as little as 5% of the shares, or in fact even a lesser controlling interest of a public utility or a controlling interest of a holding company, to be incorporated in the state of Wisconsin, so that foreign corporations are strictly not allowed to have such an investment. And the trial court recognized that that statute was facially discriminatory, but relying on the Supreme Court's decision in Lohman, said that because it was intended to protect ratepayers and was not for the purpose of economic protectionism, the per se Commerce Clause analysis did not apply. That was fundamental error. The Lohman court said precisely the opposite, that motive was not an issue. And in this court, the Bai case has said there need no be showing no economic protectionism. Instead, the analysis is very well set forth in the Meyer case of this court, both tales of which apply to the statutes here. The first one being, if it is a statute is facially discriminatory, then it is per se unconstitutional unless there is a motive other than, or an effect other than, economic protectionism, and there is no lesser restrictive manner in which to achieve the purpose. If, however, it's extraterritorial in nature, there is simply a per se finding of unconstitutionality without more. And both of those apply here. The in-state incorporation statute, as I said, draws a barrier around Wisconsin. No foreign corporation can come in and make an investment into a public utility or public utility holding company, only Wisconsin corporations. That puts a direct burden on the interstate market of utility stock transactions, which for Alliant Energy are at the New York Stock Exchange. The Baltimore gas case that was relied upon by the PSC here, in fact, recognizes that that is a burden on interstate commerce, as well as the Edgar case. And it also would put additional costs on any foreign corporation which would choose to give up its place of incorporation and come into the state of Wisconsin. In the Dean Foods case and in the Meyer case, the inquiry was made, what if every other state in the United States could promulgate such a law? And if that were to be the case, then there would be absolutely no interstate commerce in the market of controlling interest in public utilities. Alliant Energy is a good example. It has interests in Illinois, Minnesota, and Illinois, Minnesota, and Iowa, and it would have to give those up because it's a Wisconsin corporation and it's regulated by those states, even though it is not incorporated in those states. So the real issue, it seems to me, because in the U.S. Supreme Court in the New England Power case certainly has applied the per se analysis in the utility area, is not whether there's a different analysis, but because of its facial discrimination, whether there is a lesser restrictive means of protecting the economical and reasonable and safe delivery of utility services in Wisconsin other than through this legislation. The trial court determined that looking at other firewalls that exist in Wisconsin was a legislative determination, but that's simply not what the per se analysis has said in the decisions of this court. And in fact, the PSC has taken the position that that is redundant legislation. In other words, there really is no challenge. Just like in the Bay case of the waste hauling in Indiana, the government didn't bring forth a real challenge that the goals and the objectives of protecting the people there, just like the ratepayers in Wisconsin, could not be achieved in other circumstances. Same with Meyer, the recycling law in Wisconsin. They presented an expert, Mr. Hempling, who did not even talk about the in-state incorporation statute, never put forth any evidence that that would be necessary. And relying on the language of the U.S. Supreme Court in Lewis, there simply is no reason to believe that a foreign holding company would be any more likely to engage in the evils that have been attributed to holding companies than a Wisconsin holding company. So it's our view that there really is not a large dispute on the in-state incorporation statute. The statutes that are in place will cover any flow of money from the utility upwards to the holding company. Dividends are totally restricted. Cross-subsidization is totally restricted by all the statutes that are in place. And there really was no evidence to the contrary, making it per se unlawful. We then turn to the other statutes. If the in-state incorporation statute still exists, it's my understanding of the view of the PSC, well, then the other statutes only apply to Wisconsin corporations. Well, that is admittedly so, but we don't believe that it's appropriate to rely on a facially discriminatory, unconstitutional statute to shore up other unconstitutional statutes that have proven to be unnecessary for the regulatory scheme. But even if they are considered in connection with the in-state incorporation statute in place, as it was said in Bay, you don't look to the specific language, you look to the practical effect of the package of statutes. And here, a foreign corporation faced with all of these hurdles is not going to make the investment into Alliant Energy or into WPL that would be required. The reason being, they'd have to give up their place of incorporation and bear the costs that are in the record associated with that. They would also have to take the risk under the takeover statute, which is identical to the Edgar statute that was declared unconstitutional because it gives the PSC carte blanche veto power over stock transactions that in fact would take place outside the state of Wisconsin. They would then, if they are a highly diversified corporation, have to start divesting of their non-utility assets to get down to the asset cap. And then if they are outside the four narrow categories of non-utility investments, they would run the risk that they could never enter the commercial paper market by making equity offers. And collectively, those, even though they would on the face apply only to Wisconsin statute or Wisconsin corporations, if we kept the prohibition against any foreign competition in the market, would collectively still create a barrier against any foreign entry into the market. But without the in-state incorporation statute, I think the issue is much clearer, because then they become extraterritorial. I referenced the Edgar case. They become identical to Edgar because you would have a foreign corporation who would have a small ownership interest in a utility in Wisconsin, and that corporation, with taking Alliant Energy as the example, only 23.773% of Alliant shareholders are Wisconsin shareholders. So the takeover statute would prevent a transaction of shareholders outside the state of Wisconsin with a foreign corporation, not in the state of Wisconsin, and that's extraterritorial by definition. In addition, you would have, with the asset cap, you would have a non-Wisconsin corporation that had non-utility asset investments outside the state of Wisconsin. Let's use an example that you had Ohio corporation that held a 5% share of a utility in Wisconsin and also had an investment in an operation of some time in, type in Indiana. And because of the impact of the asset cap, they would be required to divest of that. They'd have to sell of that. And none of those have contacts with the state of Wisconsin. It's extraterritorial by definition. And the last one is probably the most egregious, which is if they invested outside the very four small categories of non-utility investments, then the law of Wisconsin would say to, using my example, an Ohio corporation, you cannot issue shares to raise capital, and you can't issue those shares and sell them to anybody else in the entire United States. And that's how extraterritorially, or how far-reaching the extraterritorial impact would be of the four categories, which we call the securities regulation statutes. So either with the in-state incorporation statute or without the in-state incorporation statute, the other statutes being challenged are per se unconstitutional. Now let me go back to Meyer. I may have overstated. There was in a footnote in Meyer a question whether you still have to, even in the extraterritorial area, look to see if there is a lesser restrictive means of accomplishing the same purpose. But if you did, it would be exactly the circumstance here, is that the statutes that are in place, the pervasive regulatory power of the PSC, which hasn't really been challenged, but these statutes have been admittedly redundant, meaning they are not necessary. So under any of those analyses, we believe these statutes are unconstitutional. Now, let me address, if I may, the estoppel argument, because that ties directly into whether there's a lesser restrictive area. The Fahy case, which is the lead case relied upon by the PSC, does not create an absolute bar against a challenge to a statute. Instead, what Fahy said was, and that was a savings and loan case, and in the savings and loan case, the savings and loan was allegedly engaged in some pretty bad nefarious conduct. And when the commission came in to put somebody else in as a receiver to take over and require divestment of it, the challenge was lodged. And the Fahy court said, but you can't challenge a vital condition, which is the language of the Fahy case, and especially when those vital conditions are not severable from the remainder of the statutory scheme. What we have here are statutes that are severable because standing alone, they will give the regulatory protection that is necessary. And in addition, they are not vital because, using the PSC's language, they're redundant and they're not necessary. Therefore, even under the Fahy estoppel analysis dating from 47, they would not apply. Now, the PSC has brought up the Pat Robertson case from the D.C. Circuit more recent. But similarly, in Mr. Robertson's circumstance, he took about $10 million in matching federal funds when he was running for president, and there was a determination that he had to recoup about $500,000 of those. He didn't just challenge the recoupment provision. He challenged the entire structure of the matching funds analysis. And what the court said, the D.C. court said, was, but you benefited from the overall scheme, and now you're attacking the overall scheme. And you can't do that. You're a stop from doing that. But by instruction in that case, the court said you did not just challenge such as a rifle shot rather than a shotgun approach, the recoupment statute, which at least arguably gives some signal that had he done that, he would not have been precluded from challenging portions of the statutory scheme from which he didn't benefit. Justice O'Connor in the Cattermas case said essentially the same thing. That was a school funding case for children. Now, the PSC has said, well, it's far different when you're dealing with individuals because they're not created by statute, and I concede that, but their entitlement is created by statute, and that's what the estoppel position is talking about. These people had voluntarily opted into this program, and they benefited from other portions of the program, but then when the costs of transportation were allocated to them, they were allowed to challenge that because they did not benefit from that. In this court's case, Judge Bauer, who adopted Judge Crabb's decision in the Brockert case, said essentially the same thing. That was a Madison employee's employment case where the employee was allowed to live outside the city limits. And he had done that for years and years and years and taken the full benefits of doing that for years and years and years. Therefore, his entitlement arose by the statute. But then when the waiver was withheld from him, he was allowed to challenge it because he wasn't benefiting from it any longer. We believe that the estoppel position here falls directly into that category because the North American Securities case is very instructive. That was a PUCA case. It was decided 1 year before Fahey in 46 by the Supreme Court. But the Second Circuit said that all of the provisions of PUCA were severable. And then they were allowed to challenge the portions of PUCA from which they did not benefit and under which they were not created. The same establishes here. Now, the difference in that case was that the SEC had promulgated a rule saying that by registering or filing a statement, you don't waive your constitutional rights to challenge. But the commission can't create constitutional rights. And the commission cannot provide the right to raise a constitutional challenge if a party is stopped from doing that. All it meant was the commission recognized that even though you may be governed by portions of PUCA, the Utility Holding Company Act, you may challenge other portions. And we believe the same ruling is here, that even though there was a requirement of registration under the Holding Company Act in Wisconsin, there was never a forfeiture of constitutional rights. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Piper. Mr. Hughes?
Good morning. May it please the Court. States have the right to regulate utilities that have monopoly service territories within their borders. This includes the right to regulate the utility's activities, as well as the structure of the utilities and their holding companies. The Wisconsin legislature acted under this authority in 1985 when it enacted the Wisconsin Utility Holding Company Act. Before this legislation, there was no explicit statutory authority that allowed utilities in the state to be part of holding companies or to engage in non-utility diversification. The view that utility holding companies shouldn't be authorized at all had considerable support within the state. From a ratepayer's perspective, there isn't any real rewards from utility diversification that will ultimately be shared by the ratepayers. On the other hand, there are significant risks from utility diversification. There is the risk that the management of the utility could become diverted from its core utility business by some non-utility investments or other activities. There is the risk that the utility could become overextended in risky non-utility investments, thereby damaging the financial strength of the utility and resulting in higher rates for the utility's ratepayers. There's also a danger of cross-subsidization. That is, if a holding company had subsidiaries that were both regulated utilities and non-regulated entities, the incentive and the opportunity would exist for the company to try and shift the costs from the non-regulated business to the regulated business where the customers of the utility don't have any options. So there was a significant issue in Wisconsin in 1985 as to whether utility holding companies should be permitted. Ultimately, the legislature authorized Wisconsin utilities for the first time to form holding companies that could also invest in non-utility endeavors. but in response to the views of the opponents of utility diversification, the legislation included several limitations that were intended both to limit the financial risk to the utilities and its rate holders that would that could flow from diversification, as well as to maintain the primary focus of the holding company and the utility on its utility business. Now, the key limitations the statute imposes are among the provisions that have been challenged by Alliant in this lawsuit. It's important to note that the compromise that resulted in the Utility Holding Company Act in 1985 was a process by which the state legislature balanced two in-state interests. There was the interest of the utilities to seek diversification in an effort to seek to maximize a return for their shareholders. On the other hand, there was the interest of the ratepayers in the state who had good reason to be very suspicious of utility diversification. And finally, there was also the interest of the Public Service Commission in the state who wanted to make sure that their task of regulating the utility not become unmanageable as a result of excessive diversification. The legislation did not amount to an effort by Wisconsin to give an artificial advantage to its own customers or businesses at the expense of businesses located outside the state. Nor was the legislation an attempt to mandate that in-state customers or in-state businesses be given a preferred right of access to any sort of resources located within the state, again at the expense of businesses or consumers located out of state. In short, there was no sense of economic protectionism that underlied the legislature's activities in enacting this statute. Nor did the legislation represent an attempt by Wisconsin to seek to legislate extraterritorially, that is, to seek to reach out and govern activities that take place entirely outside of the borders of the state. Now, these key facts distinguish the facts of this case from every single case that Alliant relies upon in support of its Commerce Clause analysis. Alliant relies on the Meyer case. The Meyer case was, Meyer case as well as the Bai case, both of which Alliant has cited here today, are examples of a number of cases involving trash hauling and landfill in which states have tried various means in order to impose on out-of-state trash hauling businesses the burden of slowing down the filling up of the landfills within the state. Nothing like that is at stake in this case, or nothing like that was at work by the legislature.
Well, you agree that it's a pretty common practice for public utility companies to be incorporated in different states and provide service in other states, like in the Southern Union case and in another case, the Baltimore Gas case. I guess I'm having a hard time understanding why it would be difficult to regulate Alliant if it incorporates in another state. Why is that going to be so difficult?
Well, first of all, the in-state incorporation requirement, as far as utility incorporation, Wisconsin has required utilities to be incorporated within the state since 1907. Other states have similar restrictions. So it's not a unique situation to Wisconsin. Now, when the legislature was enacting the Utility Holding Company Act in 1985, its concern was to make sure that by authorizing diversification, it did not permit the utilities to escape or to get out of the regulatory authority that the Public Service Commission already had. And so from that perspective, it was considered a prudent provision to include in the legislation, the same provision that applied to utilities. That is, not that you couldn't have an out-of-state business own the utility, but what the provision states is that Wisconsin Utility Holding Company has to be organized under Chapter 180 of the Wisconsin statutes. Now, corporations that are headquartered elsewhere outside of Wisconsin can choose to be organized under Chapter 180. It doesn't bar those corporations. Similarly, there may be there's plenty of corporations in Wisconsin which have chosen not to be incorporated under Wisconsin law, have chosen, for example, to be incorporated under Delaware law or some other state. So it's not a fair characterization to say that this in-state incorporation requirement is a facially discriminatory provision with respect to interstate commerce. It isn't. It's one that imposes a restriction on the utility holding companies in the sense that it requires the utility holding companies to be organized under Chapter 180 and thereby agree to the provisions that Wisconsin has deemed appropriate to impose upon corporations. But it doesn't, strictly speaking, have any sort of extraterritorial effect.
Well, Mr. Hughes, what advantage does it bring to the citizens of Wisconsin that requirement that in some way can't you regulate under all the other structural provisions? What limitation on regulation of utility services is enhanced by this requirement?
Well, Your Honor, all the particular provisions in Chapter 180 of the Wisconsin
assuming
statutes.
Severability here for a second.
Right.
Yeah, assuming what's the advantage, the policy advantage of having this requirement?
Because it requires the holding company to abide by the same sort of restrictions that the state has seen fit to include in Chapter 180 that the utilities in the state as well are required to abide by.
Yeah, but can you point to what advantage that brings, what added protection? I mean, is there some tax advantage? What, as opposed to the competition that might flow from not having this requirement? I mean, I'm just trying to focus, as I suspect Judge Williams is, and perhaps Judge Coffey, on what's the plus of having this requirement? What's the protection that the state is given?
Well, there are several provisions in Chapter 180 of the Wisconsin statutes that aren't commonly found in the provisions of other states. One is, for example, that individual shareholders are responsible for payments to employees if the corporation goes out, if the entity goes out of business. I can't speak to all the particular provisions of Chapter 180 and say how they differ between Wisconsin and that of Delaware or any other particular state, but the chapter as a whole reflects the state's policy as to what is appropriate set of regulations for corporations.
Well, let me ask you this. How does the regulation of only allowing Wisconsin incorporated businesses to own more than 25% of the utility company protect a ratepayer's interest? So let's be very specific.
Well, in a couple
of
ways.
So Wisconsin can own more than 25%. So the fact that the out-of-state companies could only own 25%, I mean, how does that protect ratepayers? That's very specific.
Right. It protects ratepayers in a couple of ways. First is what I've said, is that those provisions that the state deemed appropriate to impose upon corporations in Chapter 180 would be applicable here. A second one is that to the extent that, well,
yes, so in other words, is there some magic bullet when the 25% hits? Does that mean that there's more tax that's going to be paid or there's other things that kick in when it's more enemy?
No. And the restriction with respect to holding companies is 10%. Anyone, any corporation, any individual can invest as much as they want in Wisconsin utility holding companies so long as they don't exceed the 10% threshold, which in Alliance case was in excess of $250 million. So the 10% figure is used as a fairly common regulatory shorthand to distinguish between controlling and non-controlling investments. Practically speaking, the argument that Alliant has made this morning is that the in-state incorporation requirement is necessary in order to enable these other provisions, which don't have any effect, which do not have any which apply equally within Wisconsin as without the asset cap provision, the requirement that the PSC approve acquisitions of utilities, and the security regulation provision. Alliant has argued that the in-state incorporation requirement is all that keeps those provisions constitutional, because if in the absence of the in-state incorporation requirement, those provisions would be transformed into unlawful extraterritorial attempts by Wisconsin to regulate activities taking place outside its borders. And I'm not conceding that that's the point, but that that's the case, but it raises a legitimate point, and it is a concern that the state could properly be concerned about, that in order to make sure that its overall regulatory structure be upheld, in order to make sure that those restrictions that the state wished to impose on utility holding companies be found to be within the state's authority, then the argument is available and has been made that they can only be applied to those entities which are incorporated under the state's laws. So to that extent, the in-state incorporation requirement may in fact be the key to the constitutionality of the remaining provisions. At least that's an issue. That's a question, and because it is, the state is entitled to make the particular judgment that it would impose that restriction. In fact, Alliant has passed a corporate resolution stating that it wishes to change its place of incorporation to Delaware, and one of the whereas clauses in the provision specifically stated that. The reason it wanted to do that was because it was under the belief that if it were no longer a Wisconsin corporation, the state could no longer impose the restrictions that are found in WUCA upon it. So the advantage to the ratepayers is that they get the benefit of all the limitations and the restrictions that were an integral part of the compromise that led to this 1985 legislation. The argument has been made, and it is a legitimate issue, that the state is limited to imposing restrictions on, or there is a extent to which the utility the state is restricted to imposing particular restrictions on those entities which are incorporated within its state. And to that extent, requiring that the holding companies be organized under Chapter 180 of the statutes provides considerable benefits to the ratepayers.
Does that ever hamper interstate commerce of the sale or purchase of utility holdings?
Your Honor, there's been no evidence that there has been any effect on interstate commerce from these particular restrictions. First of all, it doesn't restrict any investments.
I said can it, though. Can you,
pardon?
Can you visualize where it can hamper it?
Not in a meaningful sense. There are extents to which the state has always conceded that these bundle of restrictions that are imposed on utility holding companies do make them less attractive as takeover targets. Because there are restrictions upon their activities, a corporation, whether it exists in Wisconsin or elsewhere, may well be less willing to acquire a Wisconsin utility holding company as opposed to holding companies found in other states which aren't burdened under those same restrictions. But that's not a burden on interstate commerce as the law has been developed, because the effect of that simply is to shift investments from, or at least control investments, from one utility holding company to another. And what this court recognized in the Amanda acquisitions case was you can't engage in the sort of bootstrapping argument where an in-state business says that the fact that the state is imposing burdens on us within the state makes us less attractive as an acquisition target by out-of-state businesses and therefore impedes interstate commerce. That argument has been rejected, and rightly so. So the particular restrictions that we're talking about here are certainly ones that further a very compelling state interest in effective utility regulation. The state isn't required to take one particular approach or another to this very difficult task. The legislatures are the laboratories of democracy and can experiment with different regulatory approaches so long as they act within constitutional boundaries, as Wisconsin has here. There is no substantial effect on interstate commerce. These restrictions do not change the structure of the market at all. Wisconsin is not trying to keep out new competitors. These restrictions have no effect in, for example, utilities aren't saying we want these restrictions in order to keep out other utilities who might come in and compete with us at a retail level, because there isn't that kind of competition permitted in the utility field, and that's certainly not something that's challenged in this litigation. So there isn't an effect on interstate commerce. There also, because there is, that gets to the Pike versus Bruce Church test. The district court was correct in ruling that these regulations are not subject to strict scrutiny under the Commerce Clause because there simply isn't any economic protectionism at work here, nor is there an effort at extraterritorial legislation. So because those factors are missing, strict scrutiny under the Commerce Clause is inappropriate. The provisions should be judged by the Pike versus Bruce Church test, which looks at whether the burden on interstate commerce is clearly exceeded by the putative local benefits. As I've discussed, there isn't a substantial effect on interstate commerce here, and they clearly further the strong state interest in effective utility regulation. Alliant has conceded that the state has a strong interest in utility regulation, but argues that, well, these particular provisions go too far, they're redundant, there are other provisions which accomplish the same goal. That argument isn't available to Alliant because a regulated company like it isn't free to pick and choose and say, well, we choose not to abide by these particular restrictions because you have these other restrictions on the book which achieve the same goal. States are entitled to impose both conduct-type regulations and structural regulations which minimize the regulatory burden, which facilitate effective regulation, and which have the effect of preventing those types of activities which can form the basis for regulatory problems down the road. So certainly since the 1984 AT&T consent decree, it's been clear that when you have regulated and non-regulated businesses under the same corporate domain, the type of structural regulations that are at issue here are an appropriate regulatory response. So because the statute easily passes the Bruce versus Pike Church test, the district court was correct in finding that they were that Alliant's argument that they were unconstitutional lacked merit and in dismissing the case, and that decision should be affirmed. Thank you.
Mr. Piper?
The crux of the argument was that states have the right to regulate utilities and to pass laws. That certainly has never been challenged. They have to regulate, however, and pass laws that are in conformance with the Commerce Clause, and that's what this case is about, not all the policy issues. Mr. Hughes said that allowing non-utility investments has a risk for diversification, but that doesn't mean that that's something that the state of Wisconsin can address if it does it in the fashion that it has here. The Securities and Exchange Commission has addressed that. There is an asset limitation under PUCA, but of course it is armed with the power of the Commerce Clause. If the in-state incorporation statute were so critically necessary, then one would think there'd be one other state other than Wisconsin that has it, and there is no other state that requires that.
So what?
Well,
what, that they aren't that progressive? That Wisconsin has taken that other states have followed.
I have never heard the Wisconsin Public Service Commission described as not being progressive, Your Honor. High in regulation.
Yes, sir.
And does it in a very competent fashion. But the point is, if this were a vital condition, using the Fahey language, for the cornerstone of regulation by a state of a public utility, I don't think Wisconsin would have been the only one to have found it.
California wishes they had it.
There's a real question whether this would have any impact on California. Some people say that the problems that are experiencing out in California did not come from deregulation, but came from not the free market economy in the way that it should have, and it was the way the price controls ran, but that's for another state and another argument. One thing did disturb me in response to a question you asked, Judge Williams, is maybe I was just confused, but there may be corporations in Wisconsin that are organized and incorporated under Delaware law, but they don't own stock and controlling in Wisconsin utilities. They cannot do that. And 180 isn't simply a regulatory matter. It means you have to be a Wisconsin corporation, and that's what the language means. And I've never heard that disputed until today's argument. And the purity of the motives to protect the ratepayers, that was the same argument in the New England Power case, where New Hampshire wanted from a merchant facility sell on the wholesale market electricity outside the state of New Hampshire, and the PSC said, no, we won't allow you to do that. The purpose was to protect ratepayers. It wasn't for economic protectionism, but it was ruled to be unconstitutional because it wasn't in compliance with the Interstate Commerce Clause. In terms of no effect on interstate commerce, if every state had this law, there would be no interstate commerce in the investment in the controlling interests of public utilities. The Bayh case said it's the simple fact that you impose additional costs on foreign corporations that are not imposed on Wisconsin corporations is an impact on interstate commerce. And that certainly exists here. And in Meyer, the question was whether other states around the country would have to pass laws. Those laws had not been passed yet, but the court had no problem in saying the requirement of extraterritorial compliance by other states with Wisconsin's law was an impact on interstate commerce. So I don't think that there's a real dispute as to whether the burden is here. The question are the statutes unconstitutional? We believe they are, and we ask the court to reverse the district court. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.